to our dear, deeply bereaved relative, Helen Dorothy Robert, we extend our hearts in this moment of loss, or shall I say gain, to our honored and good friends. We ask you to open your hearts and join in this joyous memorial. This is not a memorial of tears. This is a memorial of triumph, rather reminiscent of the heroic entry into Jerusalem by the Jesus, the initiate. We were rather stunned about 2 o'clock in the morning when Ellen was hammering at our door and we were told of the passing of our dear guru and friend, Dr. Franklin. When I aroused my wife and we came up here, we were happy to find that Dr. Richard Moss and his wife were already engaged in bringing the Dharma to the freed soul by the reading of the Tibetan Book of the Dead, always exhorting the listener. The important thing is to grasp the clear light continually, and we took turns in this. All of us read. It was from about 2 o'clock in the morning to 6 that we read continually from this book, exhorting the listener, the important thing is the clear light. And I'm sure it was a victorious passage. I felt that very deeply. This was no ordinary transition of death. This was a victory, because the traveler has been reaching and has reached the other shore. If I may, and my memory doesn't fail, I'd like to share some of the highlights that both Lillian and I have had with this wonderful person. We met Dr. Wolf at a lecture in Chicago roughly 6 years before his illumination. He gave a series of lectures there. Lillian and I happened to be the first ones there. And so I was there with a kind of a chip on my shoulder, because I was told by so many people that this man was most unusual in his lecture. And I awaited. And it's a lucky thing I did, because from that on, I was trapped. I was ensnared by the wisdom, the glory, and the beauty of his message. Franklin Fowler Wolf was born on the 11th day of July, the year of 1887. His father was a circuit riding minister. He tended his flock by horse and buggy. And I remember Yogi giving us some rather amusing anecdotes, eventually traded the horse and buggy in for an early car. I think the early car was a 1903 or a 1904 Brush. It was a high-wheeled vehicle with a one-cylinder engine that had a terrific propensity for backfiring. And of course, this was the scourge of every horse in the neighborhood. All horses had to be tethered. So he carried on his ministry in the best possible way he knew. We find that Franklin reached his first disillusionment with Christian doctrine. He had no questions about the crucifixion and the redemption. But he had some questions as to the resurrection. And there happened to be an official of the church, the Methodist church. And Franklin asked him to explain how the Christian doctrine of resurrection was justified. So many souls, all souls would be gathered up at the end of time, and all bodily taken into heaven. And the answer he got, he says, "Don't worry, my boy. Leave it to the Lord, my boy. Leave it to the Lord." From that moment on, the quest started. The quest that eventually was victorious in the great experience called the illumination, the enlightenment, or even in the term realization. However, he had some preliminary realizations before he did attain his great quest. He had a propensity for mathematics, and he followed this through and eventually wound up in Stanford University, where he got his master's degree in mathematics. And sometimes later, I think the year was about 1912, he was honored by an invitation to attend the Metaphysical Seminary of Harvard University. And there he was fortunate enough to hear William James, the philosopher, as well as the renditions of the Gifford lectures. Well, from there on, we go to the beginning of World War I. He was drafted, of course, and as a young man with the full knowledge of the sacredness of all life, he rejected the wearing and the bearing of arms, so he went in as a conscientious objector. Well, the authorities at Fort Lewis realized that this was no ordinary man, exceptionally brilliant mind, so they consigned him to the spruce production. Spruce was a very important product during World War I. This is beyond the memory of some of you people, because those crates that they flew, we call airplanes, were made out of spruce and canvas. So spruce production was very important. And that's where Yogi Franklin found his niche. And he found how to deal with very crude and rough, but good men. After the spruce production was in full pump, he was relieved of most manual duties. And the colonel was very much impressed with his intellect. So he did nearly all of the bookwork for the regiment. After being discharged from the World War, he still was bothered by some great questions. Questions of deep philosophical import. He studied the writings of Shankara and eventually came to the enigma. Here was Shankara, a Brahmanic, Vedantic philosopher, who disputed the monism of Brahmanism. It wasn't the prime one, the father, the Brahman. It was a new tenet in the system of Vedanta. It wasn't one. It was a reduction to zero. This began to reconcile itself in the mind of Franklin, who saw that there was a reconciliation between this Brahmanic tenet, this doctrine, and Buddhism. You know, in Buddhism, there is no individual divinity. There is no ego, the Atman, and of course, there is no Brahman. In the Brahmanic system, attain victory is to combine Atman with Brahman. So we do have a ground for reconciliation with Buddhism, which states that the evolution is carried on in cycles. It agrees with Taoist theory. It's yin at one time, yang at another, ad infinitum, without beginning, without end. You're always traveling, you're always becoming, and never arriving. That is at least for a small span of time. Well, his wanderings took him into the Santa Clara Hills at Halcyon. There he was exposed to some real theosophic teachings. He met some very noble people, and the movement was called the Temple of the People. In this center of Halcyon, he met and later married Sarah Merrill, his first wife. Sarah Merrill was a great force in his life. While Yogi had ideals of a visionary nature, a dreamer, always in the ideal state, Sarah was very practical, and she was an organizer. So the two of them together started a work, and it was enhanced by a mystic from India, a Yogi Hararama, who lectured in Chicago. I remember 1926 and 27. I attended two of his lectures, and I was totally impressed. Really had a preconception of this man that was hampered, that he did not have a good command of English language. But it was the same mystic that got together with Sharifa and prevailed upon Franklin to forego his academic career, his academic life, and devote his life to the true redemption of having man find his true identity. And so, in 1928, I think sometimes in October, Lillian and I met in Chicago, and we were very, very impressed. Now, you people have heard the latter-day yogi say within these last 10 years, with its great wisdom, you have no idea what a great force this man was in his prime. He had a terrific drive. He would arouse at a moment's notice a psychical heat that was almost impossible to resist. Everybody got uncomfortable. You can appreciate this in Chicago in the fall weather up on Michigan Boulevard at the clubrooms when it was cold outside and people began to take their coats off, began to perspire at one of the lectures. He had terrific force. It's almost impossible for me to describe this, but there was a man of force. This was the quest that eventually emerged in the Great Enlightenment of August the 7th, 1936. It was a red letter day in the calendar, really, because his contribution to American philosophy, Western philosophy, was great. He did some research into Buddhism, and of course he was a great Sri Aurobindo scholar. The three great ones on the horizon of philosophy, Shankara, Buddha, and Sri Aurobindo. He used no system. He used no particular form of yoga, although he did stress jnana yoga, the wisdom yoga. He stressed that very much. But his system was the culling of all the highlights of all the great philosophies. It was a system, rather, a method of selection, eclectic. I never remember him laying down a hard line, this you must follow, this you must believe. He had no belief systems. He had no pet tenets. It seemed that the intellect was always guided by a very common sense practicality. Well, we saw him flourish, just like a beautiful bud opening up in the full flower of the realization. And we are very grateful to him and his work that we did find our identity. We did get some real, true values in the meaning of life. So he helped us obtain the three great jewels of the Buddha. Buddha, Buddhi, Dharma, and Sangha. Buddhi as wisdom. Dharma as responsibility. And Sangha as love. Brotherly love. He stressed that very heavily. His philosophical contribution lay in the almost heretical statement that there are not only two ways of cognition which leads you to the imagination, but there are three. Two ways that were commonly used by most philosophers at that time was sense perception, intellectual, mental cognition, and that the garnering of the best of these two systems would lead you to the neurotic state. Well, he conceived the idea that the conceptual path was the direct path to part of nirvana. And he wrote a magnificent treatise to that. The cream of the treatise, according to my, I may be wrong, but according to my opinion, were those magnificent aphorisms that you find in the great book, his magnus opus, Consciousness Without an Object Also Would Have a Subject. His development and the interpretation of these aphorisms is a work of art. It's beautifully written, it's deeply thought of, and he always stressed the transcendent, that the transcendent is the most important thing. Well, first of all, we read the book, studied the book, reread the book, and then entered into discussions. And the discussions were the highlight of the whole experience. He was so lowly and so humbly, you could always tell the worth of a great man, his humility. The old adage says that he who is truly great appears as nothing in the eyes of men. That was a demeanor of a yogi. Very humble. And as Irma once said in Phoenix to me, she says, a true guru never leads you, never walks in front of you, doesn't walk in back of you to scan you, or doesn't fly above you. A true guru is your companion. He walks alongside of you. And that was the spirit. Right. We will miss him. We will miss him. His presence already has caused a vacuum in this area. May I close with one of his pet aphorisms, an aphorism he used continually in teaching in Chicago. I am divine. I recognize my divinity. I unite my consciousness with that divine self which I already am. And from that I am, I say to my personal self, reflect thou me. Reflect thou me. Reflect thou me. He also believes in the great agency of true music. We all take music for granted as an entertaining medium. It is not so. True music is exalting, and it's continuing, brings out the transcendent. Now let's hear what's transcendent from Faye and Henry, who will sing one of the great traditional songs. It's in the 23rd Psalm. Find refuge forever your presence. Thus is felt the power of great music. We simply thank that we have you with us today. Inspiration. I think to make the moment more sacred, let us all join in meditation. Let the subject of the meditation is the glorious passage by the acquisition of the clear light. Repeating the words, let there be peace within the universe. Let the power of the light.